Fascinating tonight with our guest, Walter Crittenton. We'll be back with Walter, your phone calls, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What I find fascinating, Walter, about everything in the work in your book, Lost Star, is the tremendous efforts of the ancients, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Chinese, the Mayans, the Hopis, the Sumerians, all of them in their own cultures, different time periods on this planet, seem to come up with very similar ideas of the universe, of the solar system, of the galaxy. How in the heck did they all do that separately, and it still comes out to be the same?
That's an amazing point, George. This myth about this great year cycle with golden ages and dark ages is prevalent, as mentioned, in at least 31 cultures, according to Hamlet's Mill. And yet, if it was just a myth, you would think that, you know, it wouldn't transfer so easily. That's why we think the precession of the equinox has a real purpose, that we think there's a basis in fact to this. And that's why we've been studying it at the Binary Research Institute. And indeed, we find that the precession of the equinox is not simply due to the Earth wobbling. Yes, there are some local forces from the Sun and Moon acting on the oblate Earth, sort of the classic lunisolar scenario, but the bulk of it seems to be caused from the Earth the whole solar system orbiting another star.
Now tell me more about the Binary Research Institute, how you put it together and the kind of information that comes out of it.
Yes, well, there's just a handful of us, and we've used some full-time folks and consultants from time to time, mathematicians, astrophysicists, and we've tried to study and read everything we could on precession, both from an ancient standpoint and a modern standpoint, and found that it's something that is not very well understood, and it's really nobody's job to figure out if there could be an alternative cause behind precession. And so sure enough, you know, we've found that it does have this other cause. It's due to the geometric effect, just like we talked about in Ptolemy's day. They see the sun moving around, but nothing's really around the Earth, so they think the sun moves, yeah. But there's nothing pushing the sun. Well, same thing. There's very little actually wobbling the Earth. It's the whole solar system curving through space. So we've written some papers on this, and the book Lost Star of Myth and Time is my attempt here to bring it to the public in sort of layman's terms.
The celestial mechanics involved in this kind of work and research, did you ever come to the possibility that this binary star, this binary system, creates and captures, let's say, comets or asteroids and has some effect on those things?
Yes, there's some work. Let's see, Whitmire and Matisse have talked about, you know, it could possibly be a binary or some object that causes the shear edge of the Kuiper Belt. There's also seems to be some non-randomness in the long cycle comet path. And that could be that they're stirred up by a companion star. And that's really Muller's theory up at Berkeley, the sort of the nemesis theory that, you know, this binary orbit stirs things up, and every 26, 30 million years, he's got a very long cycle, it wipes out life here on Earth. But he's basing his more on the you know, the geological record versus. We're basing ours on the actual change in angular direction that the solar system seems to be going through, and simply asking, what are we going around?
Let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. This is Wes in La Jolla, California.
Hi, Wes. Thanks for calling.
Kogo 600.
Sure thing.
Here. I'd like to ask Walter if he is familiar with a book by the late Marie Chatelain. It's called Our Cosmic Ancestors. And this gentleman was the telemetry specialist for the Apollo program and a superior mathematician. And he came up with what he called the Constant of Nineveh, which was a 64,000-year cycle based on all the things that you've been discussing this evening.
I'm not familiar with the book, but you say it's the Constant of Nineveh, like the...
I-N-I-N-E-V-E-H, Nineveh, right.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up.
It's a very interesting read, and he computed all of the locations, very similar to what Richard C. says, about 19.5, this kind of thing. But he computed all of the locations of the major monuments, and particularly the Great Pyramids, the monuments in Europe, Stonehenge, and so on, triangulated, and then he actually computed the molecular weight of the Great Pyramid at Giza. And based on his studies of the Sumerians and the ancient cultures, came up with this constant of Nineveh that came out to about a 64,000-year cycle. And he also, in that book, predicted the pole shifts, not just magnetic, but physical pole shifts that occur, and I believe he said about every 24,000 years, which is about twice the every ice age kind of thing.
Well, you mentioned the megalithic structures, and we find these, you know, all over the world, henges, dolmens, cairns, obelisks, pyramids. You know, they just found another huge pyramid in Iran. You know, how do you lose one of those and not find it for 40 centuries
really?
Later?
Even in South America when they uncover some of these things.
Oh, Corral, Peru, they found those six, and they have excellent dating. It goes to at least 400 years before Giza, and this is top-notch scientists dating it. So, and virtually all of them have some astronomical alignment feature. They're aligned with the equinox or solstice or cardinal points. So something's going on here. Why are all these ancient cultures building these structures all over the globe and so interested in aligning them with celestial coordinates?
They've got to have a purpose. It's not just for art, is it?
I don't think so. You know, when we first heard about Stonehenge when I was a kid, they said, well, they were hunter-gatherers. They could barely subsist on their crops, so they needed to know when to plant them. So they built this thing, which is so ridiculous because, you know, they would have to go, for some of the rocks, over 100 miles, cut these 50-ton stones, haul them back, align them perfectly so they would know how to then plant their crops.
Yeah. When would they have time to plant their crops doing all that?
Yeah, it's kind of silly. There's something else going on that we don't know yet, and it could be that the ancients realized we were coming into a descending age and building structures to try to hang on to the influence of the higher ages. You know, there's a saying in the Bible in Job, the sweet influence of the Pleiades. And I don't know if that is the source of you know, the electrical or magnetic or electromagnetic effects that the Earth needs, but something's going on in these ancient cultures where they're trying to tell us something.
Let's go back to the phones. First time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with Walter Cruttenden. Go ahead.
Hi, George. This is Jeff, and I'm calling from. I'm driving on I-44 somewhere outside Springfield, Missouri.
Oh, know it well. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, George. Hey, I just want to say, first time, long time, love your show. And I had had two questions for Walter.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
But he actually took care of the first one before I could get in. My first question was about Atlantis, and he addressed that pretty well. But my second question, Walter, I remember hearing, and after I ask this, I'll hang up the phone, but I remember hearing when I was younger about a perpetual motion machine, and everything that you said about the Babylon battery and the spark plug and the geode just really got me thinking about that. So I was wondering what you thought about maybe the possible existence of a perpetual motion machine in the past or the actual feasibility of that happening. And I'll get off the phone now. Thank you so much, George. You have a great show.
Okay, thank you. In your book, you had something that kind of looked like a perpetual motion machine, Walter. It was that little ball with the two bent openings that, you know, revolved. It was like a little steam engine.
Right, and that was just to show that a steam engine had been developed, again, long, long before the Dark Ages, was lost, and then, you know, brought back again to commercial use here in what, the 1800s, to show that this cycles. You know, a perpetual motion machine goes against our known laws of physics, but I'm sure that there's plenty of energy sources, and I know that you've had guests on your show that talk about it, that are a lot more efficient than our current energy sources. And it could be that, you know, perhaps this is something the ancients were tuning into. The greatest perpetual motion machines are the spinning Earth, the Earth orbiting the sun, the motion of the heavens themselves. You know, they last as long as the universe lasts.
I notice you write a little bit about the Coral Castle in Florida, Edward Leedskalden's place.
Yes, yes. What a fascinating character. Here's a 5 foot, 100 pound man who was able to move stones, some up to 18 tons by himself. And when asked how he did it, he said, "Oh, I just used the same method that the pyramid builders used."
but of course would never tell us.
Exactly. And once again, he has all these astronomical alignments, a lot of, you know, celestial motifs around there, and wrote some very mysterious books that make reference to magnetism.
You know, I was going to say that. I think he somehow understood that every object, you didn't have to be metal, that every object had some form of magnetism in it, and I think he knew how to tap into it.
Yes, I think he had some sort of higher age knowledge. And speaking of magnetism, one of the scientists on our team here, he'll actually be presenting with Graham Hancock and myself at our Sedona conference next month, November 12th. It's called CPAC.
All right. Is that on your website?
Yes, it is. Or it has its own website, cpak2005.com. And Robert Schock will be there. And quite a lineup. John Major Jenkins, the foremost Mayan scholar.
Yeah, you've got the heavyweights.
Yeah, we're trying to all get together to figure out what the ancients were up to here. But John's work on magnetism at his office, he has two giant magnets opposed to each other, locked in devices. He works for Sarah Corp, a government think tank. And he has showed that if you put an object in between these, there's about a one-inch gap or so, and move it slowly, you don't feel anything. It can slip in and out easily. But if you try to move it quickly, the magnetic effect takes hold, even if it isn't a metal object. It can be a piece of plastic. And so I think there's some laws of magnetism that we're still to discover.
Ed knew something. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
My name is Sophia. I'm calling from North Hollywood.
Sure. Hi, Sophia.
Hi. I'd like to ask one thing really quick. I think it's worth reiterating the idea that the anomalous artifacts, all these ancient technologies, so supposed advanced lost technologies, it's really not what we're talking about when we speak of a golden age. As he said previously, lost golden age 20,000 odd years ago, this would be this would be like, say, the Maltese cultures. Actually, I'd like the guest to talk about the Maltese ruins, which go back much further than Stonehenge.
Can you do that, Walter?
Yes, I've not been to Malta, but I've read quite a number of books on it, and actually Graham will touch on this subject in Sedona. You're right. They are older than the pyramids, and
they seem to have a more magical culture.
Yes, and they seem to be they're not even geometric in shape. They're more womb-like, a lot of these structures.
Yes.
Although once again, they have these astronomical alignments with the openings often opening to the equinox, and so it's we don't know much more than that because they didn't leave us any writings. And some would even say, you know, in the higher age, you don't need writing, that again, is something that's invented when we lose our ability to communicate with each other and nature and animals and that sort of thing in the lower ages.
Walter, when you were putting together Lost Star, any one thing that to you was the most fascinating?
Oh, boy. You know, it's the celestial mechanics that really get me off because you think about it, these celestial motions, they affect everything on Earth. The spinning Earth that gives us night and day, which we're, you know...
I think it's the reason why our magnetic poles are shifting now.
It could very well be, yeah. And also the, you know, the Earth going around the sun on a slight tilt causes bears to hibernate, fish to spawn, birds to fly south. It affects all life.
Just that perfect angle, too.
Yeah, just because of these heavenly motions. So we know that there are greater heavenly motions. That at the very least, we're going around the galactic center. Why wouldn't they have similar effects here on Earth?
Do you think when you look at all this, and then you look at what's going on in the universe, do you think that was all random, or it was done with a designed hand?
Personally, it looks pretty beautiful to me. I think that there are things that we can't even comprehend, higher intelligences. And
it all fits like a puzzle, doesn't it?
It sure seems to. But what's nice right now, too, is, you know, there's a lot of negativity in the media and plenty of things to worry about when you just look outside. But at the same time, we seem to be evolving fairly rapidly in consciousness. And I think we're at a fairly critical time in the world right here.
Well, I think you're right. I've got several websites for you. Do you have any particular one you want everybody to go to?
Well,
I've got Binary Research Institute. I got thegreatyear.com. I got LostStarBook.com.
They can just go to LostStarBook.com. That's probably the easiest to remember. And then from there, get to the hardcore research site, which is Binary Research Institute, or Great Year if they want to hear more about the archaeology and some of the mythology.
Who did the graphics for the cover? Good. Nice job.
Yes. Sean Freeman did a fabulous job there.
All right. Stay with us. So we'll come right back and take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. And our guest, Walter Krutkin. And we'll be back with Walter in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Walter Krutkin. He's our guest. You've got our calls. Walter, civilizations throughout the ancient world collapsed. Why? Why did they rise? Why did they fall?
The hypothesis that we have put forward is that as the sun carries our Earth, George, in this great orbit that takes roughly 24,000 years, that we go through a point in space that has beneficial influences to consciousness and detrimental influences. And we're not sure of the exact mechanism, but we know that all stars create huge electromagnetic forces and that these can affect our ionosphere, magnetosphere. And there's a gal at UCLA who has proven it can even affect consciousness. Her name is... Valerie Hunt. She's a former professor of physiology there at UCLA, and she took subjects and put them in a room, a Faraday cage called the Mu Room, and then had them do tests and found out that when she eliminates all the electromagnetic environment from the air, that people break down, they sob and perform very poorly on tests. They feel as if they're threatened, but they don't know why. And when she restored the normal atmosphere and even upped it a little bit, and I think she was adding primarily negative ions to the room, well, then people felt good and performed better on the tests and were had a sense of well-being and didn't know why. So if we can reproduce that in the laboratory, just imagine what is happening to the Earth on a very long scale if our sun is carrying us in and out of such a region of space.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Alvin.
Hi, Alvin.
Virginia.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, what I was wanting to ask is the way that, you know, your guest there, Walter, is talking about the cycles and stuff, would it be possible that the Earth has gone through everything that's already, you know, that's happened here on the Earth? Could it have gone through it before, and more or less, when it goes back around into another cycle, would it all start all over again?
That's what the Greeks say. You know, they call one cycle an eon. That's where that term comes from. And they say man has been around for eons and eons going through these cycles from the lowest age, iron, bronze, silver, up to the gold age, and then back down again over and over. The Vedic Indians say the same thing. So it is very possible.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes.
This is Mary from Oregon.
Hi, Mary.
I have kind of a dumb question here, I think, but it's a short one. I'm 82. I don't hear as well as I used to, but I've heard this term, and Walter used it, the Earth rang like a bell. I've never heard the Earth ring like a bell. And I wonder if he means something besides sound.
Well, yes, we're referring more to vibrations. There are waves coming from space that affect the Earth, Alphen waves and Schumann waves. And John Deering, the physicist I mentioned earlier, thinks that it may even interact with the Earth's own electrical atmosphere here. You know, we have lightning bolts going off millions of times every day. And so it could be that this is the way that the Earth is affected from space. But there are also some very poetic terms to it. The ancients talked about music of the spheres, and no one's quite sure what they were meaning, but maybe they were alluding to this same principle.
It'd be more vibration than sound then.
I think so. Yes, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate you being on the program. This is going by fast. Let's go to our wild card line again. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. Is that for me?
Yes, sir. It's all yours.
Well, this is Charles. I'm calling you from Harlingen, Texas, down in the Rio Grande Valley.
Yes, sir.
I know you, George, you've expressed a lot of interest in that year 2012 down through the years.
Yes, I have.
I've done my little homework through the years on the Mayans. I had a theory, and I'll tell you what my theory is, see what the both of you think about
it. Okay.
The Mayans called an age I'm forgetting my train of thought. They had a name for age called a sun. They called it a sun.
Correct.
And I think they called, they said that what was going to be unusual is that we were going to go through a back-to-back, I believe, red sun, or a red dragon sun, which is supposed to be terrible, horrible. Everybody gets maimed and killed and brutalized for a period of 260 years. That's the age of a Mayan sun. And they said we were going to go through two of them back-to-back, which would be 520 years. And their legend says the way you would start counting that 520 years is when the pale man with a dark beard appeared in their hemisphere, which would have been Christopher Columbus appearing in their hemisphere in 1492. Well, 1492 and 520 years is 2012. So I think that's how they came up with it.
Well, it could be, you know, a man that really knows that well is John Major Jenkins, foremost Mayan scholar. He's going to be at our conference in Sedona on November 11th and 12th. If you can make it, come along. He wrote the book called Galactic Alignment 2012, and I think he'll speak to that. He does interpret the cycles a little bit differently from what I understand.
Well, I thought I'd run the theory by you and wait to see what you thought.
Yeah, it's good food for thought. I'm going to run it by John.
Okay.
Good talking.
You know, I've always thought, Walter, that 2012, there will either be some kind of polar shift that they were aware of or some kind of period of enlightenment. That's my theory.
I kind of intuitively lean towards that. You know, I think the trends are getting very positive. They talk about it will bring about a new time also. And, you know, a personal hope is it will once again be conscious of the great year. You know, it's not just the day spinning, Earth spinning on its axis, or the year, the Earth going around the sun, that we'll finally be conscious of there's an even bigger cycle. And that really changes, you know, the way we look at archaeology and the way we treat ancient knowledge. Right now, we tend to denigrate the ancients. If they came before us, they were more primitive. Whereas I think there's really a great amount of wisdom there that we could use well at this time on our planet.
I think so, too. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. It's yours. Hi.
Hello, this is Vince.
Hello, Vince. Welcome to the show.
Great show. Lots of fascinating subjects.
Thank you.
My point is to make is I believe at the end of our solar system, where, you know, past Pluto, we have another body out there and some type of planetoid. My belief is that's a dwarf star out there that keeps the solar system in check. I think, you know, between Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, such heavy planets, so big, why didn't they spin off? I just don't understand what kept it in check until I came up with this idea that there's a strong body out there that, you know, follows the circular motion of the solar system and keeps the back end in check.
Well, there's certainly a lot of scientists that are thinking that way, and as you know, they've found a couple of bodies here now that appear to be bigger than Pluto, and this is just, you know, in the last couple of months, and they found Sedna and Quarar right before that, almost as big. So, yeah, we're finding things left and right now, and this Pioneer 10 and 11 anomaly that we referred to earlier, the amount that they are off course indicates that there is some kind of a mass equivalent to about 200 Earth masses within the solar system. That's if normal Newtonian dynamics work.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good. That's kind of what I was thinking. And I'm just, you know, sitting on the bench.
Well, let's help find it. We've actually at the Institute started a little prize, and I haven't even sent out a press release, so I'll announce it here, George. It's called the Galileo Awards, and it's kind of like the X Prize, but you don't have to build a rocket. And this one, you can win $250,000 for finding the lost star, or there's another $100,000 prize and some increments if you can come up with a theory of gravity that makes a visible star makes sense that it is linked to our sun. And all we're asking that it be accepted by the Astronomical Society.
Well, you're not asking for too much. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George. This is Bob from Anaheim.
Hi, Bob. I'm fine. Thank you.
I have a question for your guest with regard to we all are searching for something. And in those searches, we do various types of experimentation or what we call research. I think what we're looking at here is there's a couple of simple theories that perhaps your guest can elaborate on. That would be the attraction of a larger object to a smaller object or vice versa. And what would happen with a harmonic distortion interference of those two objects' attraction to each other may be something that he could elaborate on in his research, what he may have found in ancient areas of research or in futuristic type thoughts.
So you're saying beyond gravitational effects, it's the when you say a harmonic, some sort of resonance or discordance that occurs between celestial bodies that has the effect of affects the rise and fall of the ages?
I'm not saying rise and fall of the ages, but I am saying that, for instance, an example in current times, which is something that we're experiencing in a current daily mode, such as we've burned, 50 billion gallons of oil in the past 125 years, and we'll burn that much oil in the next 10 years. And notice in society we've turned to using silicon as opposed to an oil-based product like plastic to produce product being a computer or a cell within a computer, which we would call our chip, rather than a 78 recording disc. So I think what we've realized is something that we're a carbon-based creature and we've moved to silicon. In other leaps in technology, coming up with silicon or coming up with the transistor seems to be a great leap forward in technology for our society. However, if we don't have the energy or power to fuel all these computers that have cost us a lot of dinosaurs or oil to produce and to continue running, what good is the technology, such as the fellow who built the Coral Castle? Mm-hmm. He says, I just used the technology that was used by somebody else. And I suggest that in string theory, we're talking about harmonics. We're talking about somebody having a theory of 64 million years. It happens to be 64 notes on the piano. There happens to be a lot of theory around harmonics or vibration, and that we may just all be, the end result, matter being the end result of a vibration. But I say that we know that we can take a very large object, suspend a very small object on a bar outside of it, allow it to move in an elliptical pattern, and there is an attraction of one object to another.
Well, I think you're raising a good point, and we still have a lot to learn. You know, the ancients seemed to take great care to live closer to nature and build things out of natural substances.
Well, they had no choice.
I'm not 100% sure of that, George. The work of Philip Callahan, shows that certain stones have a paramagnetic quality, and they seem to be beneficial to plant life. A lot of the round towers in Ireland, which, by the way, are built in a pattern of some of the constellations of the Northern Hemisphere, seem plants grow better around some of them. And so it could be that they were sensitive to the vibrations created by different substances. And the point that the caller, or one of the points that he's making that struck me, is today we're producing so much stuff that generates so many vibrations, you know, from cell phones to computers to just the amount of stuff we're burning. I wonder if we are sensitive to what that is doing to the very subtle electric atmosphere that we have here and that we live in here on Earth.
Hey, by the way, you have also written and produced a documentary called The Great Year, right?
Yes, yeah. The Great Year is just a very quick summary of the book, and it's narrated by James Earl Jones. And
so could you get James Earl Jones on the show for an hour? If you pull that off, I'll carry you around on my shoulder for a couple of days.
He's a wonderful, wonderful man, but I think he really respects his privacy. So
I just want him to say, yeah. This is CNN. Isn't he the voice of CNN?
He is Verizon, Darth Vader. He is the voice. He did a wonderful job, and he said he just loved the subject, so he did it for his nonprofit.
He's
price.
Great. I like to talk to him about Field of Dreams.
Oh, good.
Things like that, and Darth Vader and stuff. But if you can, if you talk to him, let him know. We'd love to chat with him on the program.
Love to. Yeah.
Walter, I want to thank you. Good luck again. Throw out the websites, would you?
Yes, LostStarBook.com. And have people check out this conference, too, where we'll have Graham Hancock and John Major Jenkins, Robert Schock, who redated the Sphinx. And that's CPAK2005.com. That takes place in Sedona.
Great. And say hi to Graham for me as well.
Will do. He said he'd love to come on the show again if you give him the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks, Walter.
Okay.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it. George. Great night. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, who's putting in some yeoman's work for the next 2 weeks for the vacationing Lex Lonehood, Ian Punnett, Hart Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.